Imagine looking at the universe and instead of seeing this empty box filled with planets and stars and, you know, atoms just bumping into each other, you actually see a giant cosmic radar screen.
Yeah, it's a completely different paradigm.
Right, like a continuous sweeping signal where solid matter, like the chair you're sitting in right now or the ground beneath your feet, is actually just this, well, a stroboscopic illusion.
It really is a total inversion of how we intuitively experience reality because, you know, we're so used to the physics of, well, just stuff. We just assume objects exist independently in this empty void.
Which is exactly why today's deep dive is going to hopefully challenge everything you think you know about the physical world.
Absolutely.
We are unpacking a fascinating 50-page theoretical physics and signal processing manuscript. It's titled Scale Time Theory 11.0 by Andre Dubkey, and it's dated July 6, 2026.
It's quite a dense read, but very rewarding.
Yeah, very dense. But the mission here is to explore this mind-bending alternative to classical physics. This theory essentially asks you to strip away the idea of physical matter entirely, just throw it out, and replace it with the mathematics of signal processing.
Right, which sounds, I know it sounds wild.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the moment the phrase signal processing comes up, I feel like it can sound incredibly dry and, you know, intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
But the underlying concepts in this manuscript are actually highly visual.
They really are. To grasp how something solid, like, say, an apple, could simply be a signal, we first have to totally rethink the canvas of the universe itself.
Right.
The author argues that space isn't an empty container. Instead, the whole foundation of reality is a continuous global phase sweep.
And the manuscript uses this fantastic analogy to explain this sweep, which I loved. It involves a classic vinyl record player.
Yes, the turntable analogy is perfect for this.
So I want you to picture a record spinning on a turntable. Now, the angular rotation, like that sweeping motion around the center spindle, is shared by the entire piece of vinyl, right?
Exactly.
Whether you're looking at the label right in the middle or the very outer rim, the whole thing completes one full circle in the exact same amount of time.
What's fascinating here is that that shared rotation is the... it's the single invariant rhythm of this whole theoretical framework. So there's one invariant phasor frequency.
Okay.
But if you look at the physical geometry of that spinning record, a point on the outer edge has to travel a significantly longer physical path to complete its circle compared to, say, a point nestled right up against the center label.
Right. The needle on the outer edge is just covering way more ground.
Exactly. And this is where the theory maps onto our actual universe. In this framework, the speed of the carrier, which, by the way, maps directly to the speed of light, is completely constant. It never changes.
Never changes.
Okay. What changes is the scale.
Wow,
and scale, at least in this context, it doesn't just mean physical size. Scale actually dictates the length of the path that opens up under that constant speed of light.
So a larger scale radius simply means a longer circumference pass.
Right.
But the global sweep of reality hits all of those different paths at the exact same rhythm.
Yes. Though the author is very careful to point out that the universe isn't literally constructed out of, you know, mechanical clock hands or physical vinyl rings.
Yeah. No giant cosmic turntables.
Right. He uses this radar screen grammar, using terms like horizons and system baselines as a rigorous mathematical map. Mm-hmm. It's really just a way to translate the abstract math of continuous signal processing into something our brains can actually visualize.
But let me stop you right there, because this raises an immediate problem for me.
Okay, go for it.
I can knock on my desk right now. I mean, it feels completely solid.
Sure does.
So if the universe is genuinely just an abstract sweeping radar signal running on different tracks, where did the things actually come from? Like, how do we get atoms or biological cells or wood out of a sweeping phase?
That is the big question. And to answer it, we have to introduce the concept of sampling.
Sampling, like in audio or digital video.
Exactly like that. If reality is fundamentally a continuous, unbroken sweep, then objects do not exist as permanent, primitive entities. They just don't.
Wow. Okay.
They only make an appearance when that continuous sweep is sampled at very specific intervals.
Which brings in my favorite visual from the entire paper, which is the zoetrope.
Oh, yes. It's a brilliant way to picture it.
Yeah, so for anyone unfamiliar, a zoetrope is one of those antique pre-film animation toys. It's basically a spinning cylinder with vertical slits cut into the sides.
Right, usually made of brass or wood.
Yeah, and inside the cylinder, there's a strip of individual, slightly different pictures.
Right.
Let's just say it's a horse galloping.
Classic example.
Right, so if you just spin the cylinder and look over the top at the pictures, you don't see a galloping horse. You just see this continuous blurry streak of ink.
Because the information is moving too continuously, your eyes just can't resolve it into a distinct shape.
Exactly. But when you look through those vertical slits while it spins, everything changes. The slits act as a sampling rate.
Right.
They block out the continuous blur, only letting your eyes catch the images at specific discrete intervals. And when that sampling rate perfectly syncs up with the speed of the spinning pictures, the blur vanishes.
And you get the illusion.
Yes. You suddenly perceive a solid, smoothly galloping horse. The illusion of a physical, stable reality is basically born from the gaps.
That's spot on. The author actually refers to this perfect synchronization as stroboscopic lock.
Stroboscopic lock.
Yeah. In this theory, classical reality, the stable physics we experience every day, is essentially that smooth animation. The stable object only exists because the sampling intervals have locked into the continuous signal.
That is wild.
And the thing is, this isn't just a metaphor. The manuscript backs this up with some pretty extensive mathematical simulation data. Specifically, experiments E1 through E5 in the paper.
Right, the paper dives really deep into the mathematics of sampling limits, specifically looking at the structural boundary where that smooth animation just totally falls apart.
Exactly. So in traditional signal processing, there's a known threshold where you can no longer accurately reconstruct a continuous signal from your samples. It's called the structural Nyquist identity.
Okay, the Nyquist identity.
Right. If your sampling rate drops too low, you introduce errors, which engineers call aliasing.
Right.
So the author ran simulations dropping the sampling ratio all the way down to exactly 2. That means the continuous sweep is only being sampled twice per cycle.
Which creates a massive mathematical problem for the observer.
A huge problem.
Because, let's say you're looking at a spinning wheel, but you only get to see it twice per rotation. You see a spoke at 12 o'clock. You blink. You open your eyes and you see that exact same spoke at 6 o'clock. Did the wheel spin clockwise to get there? Or did it spin counterclockwise?
You literally cannot know. The mathematical sign information regarding the direction of the spin becomes completely ambiguous. The observer simply does not have the data to resolve it.
Wow.
And what the author argues is that this mathematical ambiguity perfectly mirrors quantum uncertainty. It perfectly maps to quantum spin and the ambiguity we see in particle physics.
That is a staggering claim. I mean, the paper is basically saying that quantum mechanics, all the weird, unpredictable behavior of particles at the subatomic level, isn't some separate, mysterious rule book for the universe.
No, it's not.
It's literally just the mathematical reality of hitting the absolute bottom of the sampling limit.
Exactly. The ambiguity is a structural feature of the system itself. And if you drop the sampling rate even lower, crossing beneath that edge into what the author calls the alias reversal band, the simulations show the signal doing really bizarre things.
Like what?
Well, it can appear confidently reversed, even though the underlying signal hasn't actually changed direction at all.
Oh, like when you watch a car driving fast on the highway, and for a second the hubcaps look like they're spinning backward.
Yes. Or sometimes they look completely frozen in place.
Right. But the hubcaps haven't actually frozen.
No, your visual sampling rate is just interacting with the rotational speed of the wheel in a way that creates an aliasing effect.
That's crazy.
The theory suggests that subatomic particles behaving strangely, like appearing in two places at once or locking their spin states, are experiencing that exact same aliasing effect just at the foundational limits of space and time.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because in this framework, stability is not a fundamental property of the universe.
No, not at all.
Like, a rock isn't stable just because it happens to be a rock. The stability is entirely observer relative. You only see a rock when your specific viewing slit in the zoetrope perfectly couples with the underlying signal.
It's all about how your baseline couples with the signal's residual phase.
Right. So if you have enough resolution to see past the quantum ambiguity, the math resolves into what the author terms coherent aliasing. And suddenly, boom, you get the appearance of a stable physical object.
Classical reality emerges only when the observer's uncertainty falls below the threshold of the phase structure being resolved.
Okay, I am going to play devil's advocate here for a second.
I expected nothing less.
Let's say we accept that particles and solid objects are just locked stroboscopic signals. They are perfectly synced up zoetrope horses.
Okay.
How do these animated horses interact with each other in the real world? Because if I'm pushing a heavy boulder, I'm exerting real physical effort.
Yeah, you feel it.
Right. Or if I jump out of a tree, I hit the ground hard.
Yeah.
we have to be able to explain grand macro-level forces like acceleration and gravity without relying on the physical stuff that we literally just threw out the window.
That's the crucial pivot. And the author acknowledges this transition, moving from the simulated quantum sampling bridge to macro-level physics requires applying the signal processing grammar to massive, complex systems. These are his untested extensions.
Right.
So let's tackle acceleration first.
Yeah, the paper introduces this concept called scale shift to explain acceleration. And it uses a track and field analogy, which helps a lot.
It does.
So think about a track and field event. You have runners synchronized running side by side in their respective lanes around the curve of the track.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a system to accelerate, you aren't applying some magical, invisible physical force to a solid object.
Right, there's no pushing.
Instead, you are shifting that stroboscopically locked system into a longer outer track lane.
Exactly, because the speed of the carrier wave, again, the speed of light, is invariant. Moving to a longer path lane creates a tension. Yes. To stay synchronized with the global sweep while running on a longer track, the system must undergo a change. That required change, that tension to maintain the stroboscopic lock across a new scale address, is what we actually interpret as acceleration.
So you're covering more mathematical distance in the same shared cycle. You aren't being pushed by a force. Your signal is simply realigning its track.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this completely eliminates the need to invent invisible pushing forces. Acceleration just becomes a second-order change in how a system's baseline drifts relative to the observer.
Wow.
And that concept of baseline drift, that is exactly how the theory dismantles Newtonian gravity.
Right, dismantling the classic apple falling from the tree. Because if gravity isn't the physical tractor beam pulling the apple to the Earth, how does a radar screen universe explain things falling?
Gravity is redefined here as a dominant stroboscopic focus.
Okay, what does that mean?
Imagine an incredibly massive system like our sun or the Earth. Because of its massive scale, its signal baseline organizes the phase appearances of all the smaller systems around it. The baselines of those smaller systems naturally drift in relation to that dominant baseline.
It's like a marching band trying to stay in step.
Okay, yeah.
If there's a massive, overwhelmingly loud bass drum setting the rhythm, all the smaller instruments don't really have a choice.
Yeah.
They are forced to organize their internal timing around the dominant signal just to stay locked into the song.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. The Earth isn't reaching up and pulling the apple down. The Earth's massive stroboscopic baseline is just forcing the much smaller baseline of the apple to drift toward organization.
That makes so much sense.
And what's brilliant about the author's math here is how this baseline drift dilutes over space. The organizational influence of the massive baseline spreads out geometrically over an area-like scale domain.
And spreading out over an area means that as you get further away, the influence drops off significantly.
Yes, it results mathematically in an inverse square dilution,
which perfectly mimics the equations of Newtonian gravity.
Exactly. The effects match exactly what we observe in astrophysics, but the mechanism is entirely different. It is pure signal organization, completely devoid of a primitive pulling force.
It fundamentally changes how you perceive your own physical weight. I mean, you aren't being pulled down. Your physical structure is just drifting to organize around the overwhelmingly loud signal of the Earth beneath you.
Right.
So what does this all mean, like, for the listener? How do you, sitting in your car or walking your dog right now, actually fit into this sweeping stroboscopic universe?
The manuscript actually dedicates a fascinating section to this exact question. It's under the heading Earth Scale Reference and Embodied Observation.
Right.
The core idea is that we do not view the universe from an objective, detached viewpoint. We are deeply grounded observers. Mathematically speaking, human biology shares an approximate baseline relation with the Earth Scale Reference.
We share a baseline. We are riding on Earth's specific track, looking through Earth's specific zoetrope slits.
Exactly. Because we share this baseline, the Earth appears to us as a stable, local environment. It feels like ground. But if you were a system with an entirely different baseline, say an observer positioned in deep space or on the moon, the Earth appears as a contained external spherical object. The reality of the object changes based on the shared math of the observer.
The paper also highlights this bizarre geometric quirk when mapping this shared baseline across the actual surface of the Earth.
Oh, the equatorial mapping.
Yeah. If we go back to the record player analogy.
The needle on the outer edge versus the inner label.
Exactly. Because the Earth's equator travels the greatest circumference path under the shared planetary rotation, displacement along the equator gives us our normal, everyday sense of distance and delay.
Right.
Like if you travel from Ecuador to Kenya along the equator, you traverse a massive physical path. It takes time. It feels like distance. But as you move toward the poles,
the rotational travel path begins to shrink, eventually collapsing entirely at the exact geographic pole.
At the absolute axis, the rotational path length is zero. You are spinning in place without traveling any circumference.
Yes.
In the theory's mathematical model, this creates a bizarre boundary condition. It results in a phase lapse limit that approaches a frozen horizon-like state.
Now, the author is meticulous in clarifying that this is an internal geometric correspondence within the math. He is not suggesting that the physical ice at the North Pole is literally frozen in time.
Right, right. No time-traveling penguins.
Exactly. But mathematically, the structure of the model at the pole limit approaches an unresolvable horizon. The math essentially hits a wall because there is no rotational path length to process.
It really demonstrates how the things we consider absolute truths like distance, the delay of time, even the shifting colors of redshift in astronomy, might just be artifacts of our specific viewing angle.
They are relative to our observer baseline, not fundamental laws of a concrete universe.
And from this relative baseline, the author then attempts to redefine something deeply fundamental, which is the definition of complexity itself.
Yeah, this part is really beautiful.
In classical physics, if you want to measure how complex a system is, you usually look at its physical mass or its volume or perhaps its thermodynamic entropy, like how much energy is moving around.
Right.
But in a universe without physical stuff, Dupke measures complexity by durability.
Yes.
Specifically, how many nested scale relations can remain perfectly locked together without drifting into aliasing?
It is a measure of a system's ability to maintain its stroboscopic lock despite the massive chaotic drift of the global signals around it.
So human consciousness, human biology, under this framework, you are not just a sack of meat and atoms wandering through an empty void.
No, you're not.
You are an incredibly durable, deeply nested stroboscopic lock. You are a biological miracle of synchronized signals maintaining coherence.
To exist in this framework is an active process. Existence is literally the act of remaining in lock.
Man, let's take a breath and just recap the sheer scale of the journey we've just been on.
It's a lot to take in.
It really is. So we started by completely discarding the idea of the universe as an empty container filled with objects. In its place, we established a global radar screen sweep.
Right.
We zoomed all the way down to the quantum level to see that particles are just zoetrope illusions, stroboscopic locks, where mathematical ambiguity gives way to classical stability.
And then we explored how shifting those lock signals into longer path lanes generates the tension we feel as acceleration.
Yep.
And how massively dominant signals force smaller systems to drift, creating the geometric organization we interpret as gravity.
And finally, we brought it all back down to human scale, realizing that our very existence, our perception of distance and time, is entirely dictated by the fact that we share a baseline with the Earth's signal.
This raises an important question, though, regarding the scientific rigor of the manuscript.
Right, because this is all theoretical.
Exactly. And the author is highly transparent about the epistemic status of his claims. The core sampling mechanics, that quantum to classical bridge where the structural ambiguity emerges, that is explicitly backed by simulation data, specifically seed 20599373.
Okay.
The simulations mathematically prove the structural limits of the sampling ladder.
But the massive macro-level physics.
Right, the macrophysics, the explanations for gravity, the track and field scale shift of acceleration, the Earth scale mapping, these are explicitly labeled as untested extensions.
Rather.
The author provides named test routes and suggests future simulations required to prove or disprove them. It's presented as a structured hypothetical language. He isn't asking for blind belief. It is a direct call for critical thinking and rigorous future testing by the scientific community.
Which is exactly how theoretical physics should operate. You push the boundaries of the model and then you test it.
Exactly.
But before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final thought. Tucked away in the very last section of the manuscript is a short origin note.
Oh, I love this part.
It's so poetic. It outlines the core intuition that sparked this entire decades-long project for the author. He wrote, "If you find the past in the large scales, you will find the future in the small scales.
That phrase perfectly encapsulates the underlying sampling postulate we discussed.
Thou shall.
Well, the smaller and faster the scale relation, the closer it sits to that unresolved, ambiguous sampling edge. The massive scales have fully locked into stability, but the tiny scales have not yet resolved.
Let that sink in for a second. The large scales, the planets, the stars, the deep layers of reality that have been heavily sampled and locked, that is the resolved past. But the ultra-fast, unimaginably small scales are hovering right at that structural edge of ambiguity. They are unresolved.
Right.
So if reality is fundamentally just a matter of resolvability thresholds, what happens if human technology eventually advances enough to manipulate our own observer baselines?
That's the golden question.
What if we build instruments capable of deeply sampling those ultra-fast, unresolved scales? Would we literally be able to perceive the future before it locks into our classical present?
If the framework holds true, an observer capable of sampling past the current stroboscopic illusion would be looking directly into the phase structure of events that haven't formally happened yet relative to our baseline.
It makes you wonder if our entire perception of time flowing forward isn't just a limitation of our biological sampling rate. A wild thought to mull over until the next deep dive. So the next time you drop your keys or look at the solid walls of your room, remember that you might just be looking at a masterpiece of synchronized signals locking together in the exact right moment for you to perceive them.